That's a duet from Dead Man Walking, the opera. Dead Man Walking tells the story of Sister Helen, a nun who tends to the spiritual needs of a convicted killer facing death row in the 1980s. Now, if you frequent the opera, you may correctly observe that most of the stories told in aria form are set in European courts, not American prisons. But themes like justice, revenge, regret, and redemption are total opera classics. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to hear from some of the people at the Lyric Opera about their upcoming performance of Dead Man Walking and the community outreach they've planned around it. Deborah Sandler, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As the director of Kansas City's Lyric Opera, what made you want to bring this story, Dead Man Walking, to the stage?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. It fits the bill in many, many ways. First of all, I believe in the opera. I think it's a very fine opera. It's written by Jake Heggie, who is perhaps, I don't even think perhaps, who is the most prolific opera composer of our time. His librettist is the well-known playwright and author Terrence McNally. And together they have crafted a wonderful opera based on Sister Helen's book. It is our mission to produce opera, clearly, and opera spans over 400 years of history. So to just concentrate in one historic period of, say, 75 years, we're really not doing a service to our audience. The other part of our mission is to engage with our community, and this is a wonderful piece that allows us to create several different kinds of community conversation and to let people know that opera and contemporary opera is a living and breathing art form.
We're going to get back to that because it seems like, on the one hand, yes, there's so much that's so relevant in this story, which is, of course, an opportunity to talk to people about the things they care about. But it's also possibly an opportunity to alienate people just based on polarized views and things like that. We're going to get back to that.
Okay, I look forward to that.
Talk to me about contemporary opera more generally. I mean, as we've said, the best known operas have been performed all over the world for more than a century. They're mostly sung in Italian. They deal with spurned lovers and embittered court jesters and so on. And people who go to the opera know those stories and like to keep coming back to them. Is there a groundswell of contemporary opera kind of breaking into that repertoire?
Absolutely. There has been an explosion of the composition of contemporary opera. So let me just give you some statistics. Since 1900, there have been over 1,000 new premieres. From 1995 to 2015, of the 1,000, there have been 589. So over half of the new operas that have been written since 1900 have occurred from 1995 till today.
That's so interesting. I mean, what do we know about the people writing these operas? It doesn't seem like the most obvious choice of career path to compose new opera.
Well, it's a challenge for sure. And our field has accommodated this change by offering incentives by way of funding to young talented composers. I mean, you have a lot of composers who start out writing chamber music and orchestral music, and writing for the voice is very, very difficult. There are so many nuances to what the voice does, and because of that, because it is the grandmama of art forms, it is sort of, you know, it's the high hoop, it's the slam dunk. And so a lot of composers want to do it. And what we need to understand is our field is really changing. So for the very longest time, when people thought of opera, they naturally assumed that they were going to be in very large venues. You would have 1,500 to, in some houses, 4,500 people with a very large stage. And these operas called for enormous resources. That has all changed. You see the explosion again, because our field is radically changing. You see the explosion of and creation of a lot of very entrepreneurial edgy opera companies that are performing in small, intimate venues, similar to
so
what
they aren't like the grand opera halls that most major cities, say in Europe, would have. These are.
Okay, so let me go back because, yeah. In fact, the grand opera halls tend to be in this country. In Europe, the opera houses tend to be much smaller. They'll have 1,200 seats or 1,500 seats. You won't have 3,500 seats, and that is a big issue. So what we are now seeing is, just as we started a second series this year called our Exploration Series, which we talk about eclectic performances in intimate spaces, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a lot of opera written for intimate spaces.
Wow, that's super interesting. I mean, what about audiences, though? I mean, how do you balance traditional opera with newer stuff for audiences? Because, like I said, people who have loved opera for a long time, they might be open to something new, but really, there's something about going back to the things you know and love. I mean, if you've been going to operas for decades, you aren't necessarily going because you're expecting to see something new. At that point, you're going to be seeing a lot of the same stuff over and over again, and presumably you like that.
Well, the word balance is a very good word, and that's exactly what we try to do. And it would be very... It would not serve our audience to assume they are all of like mind. So we have people in our audience who only want to see traditional productions of operas that are, again, from the 19th century. We also have a younger audience that we are trying to engage, and they are more interested with what's happening now. And we try to balance so that we spread the net wide enough so that we capture everybody in it. But I will tell you that if we're talking about trends in the opera field, the trend is to contemporary work and very powerful productions with high production values. In fact,
what do you mean by high production values? What kind of things?
It means we really care about what the show looks like. We really care about the visual elements of our production. So it used to be that in the early 20th century, scenery consisted of painted drops. And then we started to get into more realistic scenery. And then we started to move into really interesting collaborations with beautiful designers. In fact, many designers are now driving the concept of the work. People think that operas are director-driven. And in my experience, it's at best a collaboration between a brilliant visual person who understands the field and the director. And I am particularly interested in the visual arts. So what shows look like is very, very important to me.
Okay, well, let's get into the current show so that we can understand how some of this plays out. Tell the story, just the story, of Dead Man Walking as briefly as you can. I mean, for those who haven't read the book or seen the movie, which is probably how a lot of people have encountered it, lay out the main characters and the drama that unfolds between them.
Okay, well, the main characters are Sister Helen and Joseph DeRoche, and the central nugget of the story is she is a nun, and she is asked to basically be a pen pal to Joseph, who is on death row. The story starts with there will be brief nudity. I want to let everybody know that. There's some violence, but we start the show with seeing the actual crime committed. So there's no question as to whether he participated in the murder.
And the people murdered were teenagers, right?
They were teenagers, sort of in a Garden of Eden-ish kind of environment. So the two of them were alone, and they thought they were alone in a secluded place, and they were pounced upon, and they were killed. That's how the story begins. And then Sister Helen is asked to be a pen pal to Joseph, and she has ambivalence. She has ambivalence about it. And her ambivalence continues as the story progresses, and we see how she reacts to Joseph and tries to help him. And then we look at his path and how he's adamant, but he doesn't want to be killed, and he has a lot of excuses as to why he shouldn't be killed. And then eventually she learns that she has to be sensitive to the needs of the perpetrator and the needs of the victim. But Joseph,
The victim's families.
But ultimately, you know, he does not get the pardon that he seeks.
So this is no Rigoletto in my perspective, but I mean, kind of is it?
Okay, I'm going to ask for a little more help with that. In what way?
Well, you know, we have these lovers being pounced upon and murdered from the get-go. There's no build-up to something, the catastrophic violence in the story. Although, you know, like in an older opera, violence would very likely be a big part of the story. The idea that someone dies in an opera, dies violently, is certainly not new, but it's in a context that's so maybe distant from most of our daily lives, like the idea of violence happening in behind the scenes in a court, you know, is so, it doesn't feel as real.
Well, if I were an opera director, I would say to you, if I were staging Rigoletto, it's my job to make that feel real to you today. What we don't want is the distancing. You know, when we look at other art forms, we find in general that audiences are more receptive to this kind of instant connection with what's going on. Now, again, theaters tend to be smaller, so you feel that immediacy. But I think that there are themes that are the same in Rigoletto and Dead Man Walking.
Like what?
Well, you've got a death. You've got a feeling of betrayal. You have a feeling of trust. You know, the similarities that we tell stories. Opera is musical storytelling. And we're talking about people's emotions. And so while the specifics may be different in each story, opera, with the music, guides the listener to a heightened experience. And that's what we're doing with all operas.
I want to bring David Adam Moore into this conversation. He plays Joseph, the convicted murderer in Dead Man Walking. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Talk to me about this role as you have interpreted it.
Well, I think Joseph Desrochers is, he's a kind of figure who isn't often represented on the operatic stage. And that's part of what attracts me to him, because he comes from a very socioeconomically disadvantaged background. In the South, and he's part of this sort of rural working class American that we don't see much of on the operatic stage. Excuse me, and we get to trace his journey from the time he meets Sister Helen and the sort of armor that he's built up to defend himself psychologically melts away. As he gets to know her and as he in a way experiences emotional openness or emotional intimacy for the first time. But it's a tough nut to crack.
What's tough about it?
When someone has grown up in such a way that they have everything stacked against them, you know, the natural human response is to build defense mechanisms. And when you've got defense mechanism after defense mechanism, you know, sort of compounded on top of one another, it's very all of a person's. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold right now.
And fortunately, the performance is not this weekend.
Yeah. Fortunately, I'm on the tail end of it, Deborah. By the way.
Yeah, David.
you'll be happy to know.
Take care.
So he has so much psychological armor that Sister Helen has to get to in order to counsel him, that she has to get through, and of course the prison environment, galvanizes this kind of psychological armor, because you have to be in a state of hypervigilance when you're in a prison environment.
You know, is the social relevance and the social, I don't know, like the controversial kind of aspects of this, is that something you relish, or does it create challenges that maybe as a singer you feel a little like you're not sure how to handle?
I would say I don't think relish would be the word, but it certainly gives me a sense of mission, in the sense, and I just want to say a huge amen to everything that Deborah just said about us bringing the reality of human situations to opera, because it at the end of the day, it's my job to just to bring the reality of this character and to bring the audience into the most intimate psychological space of the character.
Well, I want to play a clip
And
from the movie version of this story because that's what so many of our listeners are likely to know. This is a really intense scene when Joseph is on his way to be executed, and Helen meets him in the prison hall as the guards escort him.
this is Helen. I'm gonna die.
Oh, the truth has made you free.
You gotta know the truth about me. I'm going to a better place. I'm not worried about nothing. You all right?
Yes, I'm okay. Christ is here.
I'm not worried about anything.
Okay. Look, I want the last thing you see in this world to be a face of love. So you look at me when they do this thing. You look at me. I'll be the face of love for you.
Yes, ma'am. Time to go, Poncelet. Can she stay hell and touch me?
Yes, she may.
Dead man walking!
The scene seems like it would be hard to do in opera because of the quiet of it. And I know that this is the film director's interpretation of a story, but part of what gives it that intensity is this quiet between them at this really intense moment. And David, I'm curious about how this scene unfolds in the opera. We heard "The Truth Will Set You Free" in the very beginning of this show, and I'm guessing that that duet happens here.
Yeah, it does. And I think Jake did. I was just thinking as we were listening to that, of what a wonderful job Jake did of setting this to music, in terms of setting the text. And the spaces where you hear silence in the movie, the advantage of opera is that you get to provide a sort of subconscious guide to the audience through the use of music. So the silence is still perceived when the singers aren't singing, but then you have this undercurrent of music. That's helping you weave your way through the scene.
What vocally can you talk to me about? You've talked about the character being economically disadvantaged and from the American South. How do you handle that character vocally?
Well, I sing anything with the same technique because, you know, opera, the thing that defines opera is a very, very strict standard of vocal production, and it's something that we work for decades to perfect and to master. So within the confines of that particular technique, I do things like, for instance, I sing in what's close to my native accent. I'm originally from Southeast Texas, and half of my family is Cajun. And this character, this composite character, is Cajun, and he's a composite of two different real-life men who Sister Helen counseled, Elmo Patrick Saunier and Robert Lee Willie. And I think more about Pat Saunier when I'm developing this character. And so I sing, I do it with a southern, it's a Louisiana accent with a slight Cajun twang to it. I've tried to go full Cajun in the accent, and it actually makes the diction really difficult to understand.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that he's let's say he's not terribly educated. I mean,
we're gonna get back to that.
Yeah, sure.
But when KCOR Central Standard returns is when we'll do it. We're going to hear how Dead Man Walking is engaging local communities in a way that some older operas might not. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's coming right up. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about Dead Man Walking, the opera. It's set on death row in an American prison, and I'm here with the Lyric Opera's Deborah Sandler and David Adam Moore. Welcome back, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being.
David, you were just talking to us about that your character, Joseph, who's a convicted murderer, kind of experiencing redemption just as he heads toward his execution. You were talking about that you're playing a character who is from a socioeconomic background we don't often see on the opera stage, including his education level.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you were asking about what changes I would make in terms of singing or how I would portray that vocally.
Right.
And I think there are certain types of phrasing and inflection that people use within that region. And I think Jake wrote a lot of that into the vocal phrases. And so it becomes very easy to take advantage of. And for me personally, it's such a relief in a way, because I've spent most of my professional life trying to stay away from my native accent and trying to sing with a neutral accent. Often I have to sing with a British accent. And often I have to sing, much more often I have to sing in foreign languages with a neutral accent within that language. And so for me to be able to relax vocally into my own native accent or some variation thereof has been quite a gift, really.
You do not sound Southern to me right now.
Well, I do when I'm not speaking in my fake accent.
So wait, what you're doing right now is what comes naturally to you?
Well, I mean, I've lived outside of the South for so long now that I've sort of adopted a more neutral American accent. And also I work abroad a lot, and it becomes very important there to not speak with a regional accent so that you can be clearly understood when working among non-native speakers.
Interesting. Well, I want to turn to Deborah. Deborah, according to the Lyric Opera's website, you're hoping to provide a safe space to discuss the complex issues that Dead Man Walking raises. How exactly are you doing that?
That's a very serious statement.
Yeah, it is.
We have compiled an array of different activities that let us explore this work from a variety of perspectives. So, for example, we encourage people to read the book, and there is a book group that's happening. We are looking at the notion of forgiveness, which is in the story and is a theme. And so we are doing something at Unity Temple.
And you're doing that with a group of parents of murdered children.
Yes.
I mean, that is really intense.
Right. This is an intense topic. We are living in a very intense time. This is a safer, intense topic compared to what's going on in the news right now. But it is topical and is very topical for us, considering that we are in Missouri and in Kansas.
What do you mean by that exactly about
our
location?
Well, because the executions that happen in Missouri. There are other issues that are delaying them now, but that's a separate issue. We are also going to take head on a balanced, we hope, conversation with our partners in American Public Square, and it will be filmed by KCPT, and we will be talking about the death penalty. And I know that we say, so I'm going to own something right now. We talk about Dead Man Walking as being a story of Sister Helen's journey, but in fact, it does talk about the death penalty. It is about the death penalty.
Yeah,
it would be impossible not
about the person
right.
who dies at the
it's
end
it,
of
right.
the story.
It humanizes. It humanizes, and that's what art does, right? I mean, it humanizes a conflict, a concept, a discussion, and we have to be able to have it. And we want more people in the community to understand that what we're doing on the stage matters to them, and it's a way to talk about things. So again, we have created this very robust group of activities.
But do you worry that mixing politics and opera might alienate some of your audience?
You know, politics has been mixed in opera for a very long time. Verdi was extremely political. Mozart was extremely political.
Explain that.
Well, you know, we just did Figaro, and it was based on the Beaumarchais plays. And, you know, it was banned. It wasn't banned because somebody didn't like the tune. It took on difficult political issues that had to do with class. You know, it led to something. Now, I'm not saying that the play itself led to it, but the topics that are in the play, you know, had something to do with that little unpleasantness called the French Revolution. You know, and Mozart very humorously, but seriously, takes us through this. You know, Verdi, I mean, look at Tosca. I mean, opera has always been involved in politics. All art in some way talks about politics. And opera is, again, a living, breathing art form, and it is no different. So that's what we do.
David, is that how you see it? I mean, do you feel like when you perform in operas, you are engaging politics pretty consistently?
Well, I think, as Deborah so eloquently said, these stories, when they are effective, when they are at their best, they represent realities that people can understand and immediately relate to. Marriage of Figaro is a wonderful example because the play was written in 1784. The opera premiered in 1786. The play was banned in various parts of Europe between 1784 and 1786. Imagine the Met producing a two-year-old play that's been banned in like half the states in the U.S. That's how relevant it was. And it was set in a completely contemporary setting with completely contemporary characters. And so when I'm approaching an opera, I'm always thinking of it as if it were just written and I'm the first person performing it. So I love new music, and contemporary music is where my heart is in many ways. But what I define as contemporary music my definition for what constitutes contemporary music is pretty fast and loose, because even if an opera is a few hundred years old, I'll still think of it as a contemporary opera that has just continued to be performed for a very long time.
I'm going to challenge you on that just a little bit. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but for your audience anyway, I mean, as soon as you step out of the theater, even if you are imagining that it's right, you know, that the French Revolution is newly controversial, the reality is that the French Revolution, as we now think of it, is in 2017 a little less contentious than capital punishment.
But the French Revolution involved a lot of capital punishment, obviously.
Via guillotine.
Absolutely. And the power dynamics, the interpersonal relationships, the social controversies and problems that existed within that historical context still exist today in different forms. And so, you know, there's at the end of the day, opera is about very universal, very elemental things. You know, there's human suffering, human strife. I could go on, but you know, love, death, sex, these sorts of things.
First Amendment.
Wow. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Dialogue of the Carmelites. I mean,
absolutely.
Well,
The dynamics between the powerful and the powerless.
Right. David Adam Moore, Deborah Sandler, with me from the Lyric Opera of Kansas City. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having
Great.
Us.
Thank you.
See you soon, David.
The Lyric Opera.
Yeah, see you very soon.
The Lyric Opera is performing Dead Man Walking in early March, and those community events we talked about will be happening through the month of February. You can get all the info on their website. And coming up, KCUR Central Standard talks with a photographer who documents personal belongings left behind at the U.S.-Mexico border. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now the fate of migrants is on Americans' minds, and plans for a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border have the future of that passage or line of demarcation, depending on how you see it, playing prominently in people's imaginations. Our next guest has spent time looking at that border up close. He was a janitor and landscaper at a Customs and Border Control facility in Arizona in the early 2000s. Tom Kiefer, good morning.
Good morning.
You're an artist, a photographer to be specific. What led you to take a job at a border control facility?
Well, a little bit about my background. I started out in Wichita. That's where I was born. And our family moved back to Seattle, which is where I was primarily raised. I spent the next 20 years down in Los Angeles working in advertising, graphic arts, graphic design, and I always had an affinity towards photography. And in 2001, having had enough of L.A. and to take better control over my destiny in terms of my living situation, I moved to a small, tiny, former copper mining town called Ajo, which is about 40 miles from the Mexico border and 100 miles from the California border, to concentrate on my art, my photography. And in 2003, art doesn't really pay for itself.
Not usually.
Not usually. And I took a job part-time as a janitor at our local Customs Border Patrol station. And so that was it. It was just purely to, just to have a little bit of extra money coming in. And, again, it was part-time, so it allowed me just to continue on with my work. And when I started in July of 2003, what was, the first time I'd really been working for someone else since, 1985, and it was just one thing that struck me immediately was the agents, the Border Patrol agents. They pulled the food that the migrants carried.
Wait, back up.
As their, okay.
Because before we say what they did, I mean, what exactly happened at this facility? I mean, what went on there?
Well, so the station is about 30 miles from the Mexico border. It's in a very rural location. And so it is a facility where Border Patrol agents work out of, and they go into the desert and find people illegally crossing the desert. And so they apprehend them. They bring them to the station, and that's where the first stages of processing intake begin.
So when you say processing, a lot of people, I mean, I remember, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember, in the last couple of years, there have been issues of migrants and particularly child migrants being in detention. Was this often the beginning of that detention process?
No, the facility that I worked at was, I don't know what the term was called, but there would never be any long-term detention. They would just, it would be like a police station. The first stage of, they're identified, fingerprinted, and then they go to their next destination. And depending on what their record might bring up, they could be sent to Phoenix or Tucson or Yuma. So it was just the initial stages of identifying and then determining where they would be going next. So this station was not designed to house anyone for, anything like the detention centers you're talking about or referring to.
So you were struck by one very specific moment in these interactions?
What happened was, I had mentioned that the agents themselves were collecting food out of the trash when I started working there and brought that to our local community food bank, which I thought was a very decent and humanizing thing to do rather than have this perfectly good food go to waste, sent to the landfill. They were, digging it out of the trash and bringing it to our local food bank. And that went on for a couple years, and then we had a change of leadership, and the food collecting came to a halt. The station chief didn't want the agent spending company time doing that, and so for the next 2 years, all this perfectly good food was being thrown away, and that was just kind of painful because, why? And
and this was the food being carried by migrants?
By the migrants, so canned food. I mean, perfectly good. I mean, it wasn't like fresh produce, even though there was obviously fresh, apples, oranges, things like that. I asked, it was about, I had been working there for 4 years. I said, hey, can I bring this food? And the supervisor on duty, his exact words were, bless you. And they were just happy. I mean, they couldn't do it, so I volunteered. And that is when, I'd been there for 4 years. That is when I really witnessed and saw for the first time the deeply personal effects and belongings that the migrants were carrying that they had to give up.
Why did they have to give them up?
Security risk. A belt can be used to harm themselves or others, shoelaces, combs, toothbrushes that could be filed down to use as a weapon, things like that. So anything that was considered potentially lethal or non-essential was discarded. And that's when I saw a rosary, I was just like, oh my God, this, I couldn't let that just remain in the trash.
Can you explain why not?
Because it's a very deeply personal item. I mean, if I saw it on the street, I would pick it up. I mean, there are just certain things.
Like just that it meant something to someone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, or a Bible or a photograph of a family photo so I started and extra clothing.
Yeah. And you ultimately.
I mean, it's just like, why is this being thrown away? And so at first, when I started collecting, and I was doing this discreetly, I was allowed to collect the plastic, cardboard, and aluminum for recycling, and of course the food. And so I would just discreetly, put in a blanket that the migrant had carried, or shoes, clothing, and I'd bring it to our St. Vincent de Paul's thrift shop. And then as it just continued, and then there were obviously some things you just wouldn't donate, brushes, combs, toothbrushes, but, there was just so much of this, I quickly realized that this is a much bigger story going on here.
Yeah.
And
you ultimately assembled like items, kind of, like, so a bunch of wallets, and took photographs of those kind of, like, neatly arranged together. So in one photograph, you'd see just tons of wallets kind of positioned so that you can often see the contents and things like that. Why did you want to have a bunch of one thing in each photograph?
Well, and sometimes when I do that, it's just to show the mass, the volume. And another thing about how I arrange these items, I saved these, so to speak, out of the trash. And so I have great reverence and respect for these objects. And, when I assemble them, I do this in a way that I want you to see each item that I'm putting on there, for the most part. I mean, on occasion, there'll be, like, a bunch of gloves, leather gloves, winter gloves, that I'll just kind of make a sea of gloves, not the point there is just to show this kind of sea of humanity, so to speak. And other times, like the wallets, I thought that was much more, I mean, that's such an important personal item that to just dump those on the ground and make it look like, they're just a pile of trash, to me, would be absolutely disrespectful. So I'm very so these are sacred, important objects. That's how I approach them and how I want to present them.
A handful of these photographs are on display at the Nerman Museum right now in an exhibit called Domestic Scene, and I went and saw it yesterday, and the wallet image It looks one way when you first see it, and then as you, it's printed large enough that you can really see each one, like I was saying. And as I was looking kind of closely at each wallet and imagining what I could about the person who might have been carrying it based on just little hints, the one that kind of got me, I don't know, and I wonder if you can tell me the story behind this. There's an address, a tiny address book that looks like it's been maybe removed from one of them. And that just kind of makes you think about all of the people who love and care about this person, and that they are in this sort of state of unknown future, you know, like the and present. I mean, for probably the people who care about them, they're not aware that this person has just been apprehended at a bus, at a customs patrol facility. And so I'm curious about that address book and the sort of, I don't know, little details like that, where it's maybe as you've looked at wallet after wallet, you can kind of see it as this formal thing. But then there's a moment where it's like, oh, wait, that's a person.
This is attached to a person. This is a real person. And the other thing that people aren't really completely aware of is a number of these people apprehended are not just coming to the U.S. for the first time. I mean, they live here. And have lived here for years, if not decades. And their reason for going down to Mexico or South America was probably a very personal and important one, like a family member passing away, and they were not going to miss that funeral, and they knew what the risks were, and that's why they were crossing illegally in the desert. So, I mean, these are people. These are the... You know, people work in the construction industry, the service industry, the fast food industry, and because they maybe were, 15, 20 years ago, they came with their parents when they were just a baby or a young child. I mean, and they've been living here since then, being a good citizen, and this is what, you know, so yes, I mean, I hope that my photographs can convey a sense of humanity and respect and thought about what we're doing in the So
there's one of the images on display at the Nerman has, it looks like, books of Psalms and
New Testaments, and those are interesting. I don't have the photograph up in front of me. But those are New Testaments that were published in Tennessee, and they were donated, distributed by people of that faith, that church. And and one of them on the inside cover of one of the New Testaments is a person was keeping a diary of when they set out on their trip, when they crossed the U.S.-Mexico border. And I can't remember the exact date, but I think it was around August 9th, 2009. And you think about that, it's like, you know, it's 100 degrees plus in August here in Arizona in the desert. And, you know, what was it that was so important that that person was crossing at that time of year? So they were apprehended on the seventh day. They kept a day-by-day record of when they were in the desert. So it's like, why are we throwing out a Bible?
There are several Bibles in that photograph, and they're all identical, which you've kind of explained.
Right.
But then in all of these, not all of them, but I would say, you know, like there are a bunch of shirts, and they're all kind of the same cut of shirt, you know, a short sleeved collared shirt, like
a polo shirt.
Yeah. And then there are a bunch of work gloves. I mean, I'd call them work gloves, and they're
right
in a pile, and they're identical. And then these Bibles are all identical. And it strikes me, I mean, is that something that you had to comb through a bunch of stuff to find the identical stuff? Or is it just the case that people crossing the border, that there's sort of a consistent, like the visual equivalent of a litany? You know what I mean?
Well, like with the Bibles, I really you know, maybe over the years, you know, I was collecting from 2007 until I resigned in August 2014. And all told, I maybe found a couple dozen Bibles. And, you know, what I can't remember, you know, I may have found like two or three of, you know, this one particular pocket Bible. And then sometime later on, I found another one, and then another two or three. So it's just like, well, let's put those together. That makes sense.
I just realized that I'm asking you to tell me what it means, or, you know, what I'm asking you to tell me more about the people carrying these things and why there are so many similar things. But I guess you are kind of in the position of the people looking at your photographs, in that you don't meet the people, you don't know, you're just seeing the objects too.
Right. I saw them in the trash, and I took them out because I thought, you know, this was very important to record this very unique time in our country's history, this mass migration that we're still, I don't want to say clueless, but we're just not, and the right word isn't process, but we're just still processing this. I mean, we're just trying to make sense of it. And I mean, this has been going on ever since there was the United States.
Did you get in any trouble when you went public with these photographs? I mean, you hadn't like your colleagues who were agents been told not to mess with the trash, but it does seem like maybe you weren't doing what was intended with these objects.
Right. And I was aware of that, but, you know, to me this was more important to tell the story and just not have it, you know, disappear into something that never happened. So to answer your question, no. And
you didn't get in trouble.
No, I didn't. And I certainly consulted with, you know, a few lawyers and just to assess what the risks were. You know, this is not some diatribe against the government or the Border Patrol, not at all. So that's not where I'm coming from with this. And
when
it's
not a diatribe against them, I mean, these are the, speaking of humanity, I mean, there's the humanity of the people crossing the border, and then there's also the humanity of the agents who work at this Border Patrol facility. And you worked there. I mean, you worked there because you needed to make a living. And I wonder, when you think about humanity in that spot, what you do have to say about the humanity of the people you encountered on the other side who are doing the job of removing these items.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry. I don't know quite how to answer that. I mean, first and foremost, I'm an artist, a visual artist. I use the camera, and I'm just, I don't want to say that this is a strict documentary. I'm just showing, you know, how we're what gets thrown away, and, you know, there, you know, the one critique or criticism that I do have regarding the Border Patrol is that these personal items, the ones that shouldn't be separated, need to be better safeguarded, or accidents of it being thrown into the trash, that doesn't happen. You know, that it, yeah, so I hear music.
Well, yeah, because our time is sadly up, but this has been a really interesting conversation. And Tom Kiefer's photographs are part of an exhibit at the Nerman Museum at the Johnson County Community College, and it's called Domestic Scene. The whole show is pretty intriguing. You can see it through the end of March. Tom Kiefer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You can listen to either of this morning's conversations about Dead Man Walking the Opera or photographs taken on the U.S.-Mexico border at kcur.org/Central Standard. They'll be ready for you by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. If you missed this week's shows with editorial cartoonists taking on Trump and Russian immigrants reacting to recent news, check those out while you're there. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend, everyone.